Isaiah chapter 9, we're going to read the first 7 verses. Okay, hear the word of the Lord. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you, as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Thanks, Josh. Good evening. My name is Matt. I am indeed one of the pastors here. And we ran out of these news notes, but if you have one of them and you don't have a Bible, on the reverse side there is the passage that we're going to be looking at tonight, so that might come in handy. And if you're a regular in our evening service, then you will know that tonight we are doing a special service. As you're all kind of aware, we're doing a Christmas in July, but we're staying in the book of Isaiah. So the series is still Bright Hope in Dark Times. But as you can see, we've gone to a great extent to make this Christmas themed, and we spared no expense in our graphic design budget to make this Christmas themed. So check that out. And you'll have no idea how long it took me to work out how to spell bauble before I could Google it. But that is a Christmas bauble right there. Money well spent. And the message this evening is entitled Dark Versus Light. And I'm going to introduce this idea by showing a trailer for a film that I think has actually been and gone, but my finger is not on the pulse of pop culture. And may I just say, particularly for those people that's got kids, probably under the age of kind of 6 or 7, this has been approved for public consumption for all audiences, but I was a wee sensitive little kid, and so I am sensitive as I see these things. So if you've got a little kid that's a little bit sensitive, you might want to distract them, cover their eyes, put a bag over the head, but it does only last, maybe not the last one, it does only last a minute and 59 seconds, I think. So here's a trailer for you.
Gift of new, gift of old, bless the righteousness, guide my hand against the darkness, my final stand.
Barbara, I want to get to know you a little bit more. Do you have many friends? What about your sister?
I play your dragons or whatever if you ask me to.
That would be hilarious. What are you doing? What's it for?
There's some serious stuff going down. I find giants. I hunt giants. I kill giants.
Cool. Yeah, that's it. Dark omens are totally cool. A giant comes to a place and takes everything from you. And when it's done, it's like anything that made your life good was never even there.
Giants aren't real.
Then why are you sweating?
I know that no one likes me. I know that everything I do looks crazy.
This isn't real.
You're not listening to me! This giant is coming! We're gonna save this town.
There are times where you have to ask yourself, do I want to live my life as a coward or a warrior?
Sorry, my water's not there. I'm grabbing it, but can't make it appear. Well, you're probably wondering, what has killing giants got to do with Isaiah? Fair enough. Give me about 13 minutes. Now, I chose this film, but I really could have chosen any number of films. An almost innumerable number of books, short stories, graphic novels, poems. Because it is a story we've heard 1,000 times before, isn't it? The unlikely hero, a building threat that no one else can see but them, a call for courage and bravery in the face of overwhelming odds, outmatched, outgunned, powerless. It's a classic tale of good versus evil, light versus darkness. And it really could be 1,000 or so others. And yet, conceding its kind of unoriginality and its kind of derivativeness, you have to concede that you probably still want to watch it, don't you? Well, probably over half, I would guess. Might not be your bag. But that idea of light versus dark permeates so much of the fiction that we consume. So why don't we get bored of it? What is it that draws us back to that image of light and darkness? I think it's because deep, etched into our souls, is an understanding of that fundamental binary of good versus evil, of light versus dark. And that etch within creates an itch in us, an itch to see good triumph, an itch to see light conquer, an itch that is partially satisfied with films like I Kill Giants. It's that yes moment we feel at the end of pretty much every action film, at the end of Harry Potter, at the end of pretty much every Marvel film, at the end of The Lord of Rings. Well, actually 30 minutes before the end of The Return of the Kings, then it just goes on and on and on. And it's a yes that we feel in real life too. When we see justice done, when evil people are jailed, when tyrannous regimes are brought down, when famine ceases and wars stop. We rejoice in fantasy and in reality when that itch, even if partially, is scratched. But the satisfaction in fiction differs from our satisfaction in non-fiction. Because the triumph of good over evil, light over darkness in fantasy is almost always far less complicated, far less ambiguous than reality. Good triumphs and then the book ends, the film ends, it's wrapped up in a nice little package. But in reality, it's never so simple, is it? In the real world, the triumph of good over evil is always a messy affair. You see, the bad guys are put on jail, but then they have the lawyer that gets them off, or parole within too few years. An evil regime is brought down and a worse one replaces it. You cut off the head of Saddam Hussein and then the hydra of ISIS arises. Wars cease, yes, but to the victor goes the spoils and people pick over the carcasses of country and people are worse after than they were before. Good's triumph is never complete and never long-lasting. Neat in fiction, messy in reality. Sorry, let me go through there. So this is the question. Why is good's triumph incomplete, messy, and short-lived? And to answer that question, we're going to look into the book of Isaiah. We're looking at Isaiah chapter 9, so have it in front of you or have it on the sheet in front of you if you can. Now, who and what is an Isaiah? Isaiah was a man, a prophet, about 740 to 681 BC, so almost 3,000 years ago. And he was a prophet speaking truth to God's ancient people, the Israelites. And chapter 9 that we're looking at is hope-filled. It's a passage of triumph, a passage of light breaking through and conquering. But before we dwell on that, we need to go back a few steps and actually spend some time in the darkness. We won't understand the light unless we feel the darkness. And so let me give you, so chapter 9 we're looking at, let me give you the last verses of chapter 8. They will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry. And when they are hungry, they will be enraged and will speak contemptuously against their king and their God and turn their faces upward. And they will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into thick darkness. This is Isaiah drawing upon all his kind of poetic acumen and skill to kind of paint it as pitch tar black as possible. It's a picture of doom. And we might miss it, but it's actually a deeply ironic picture. Because here Isaiah speaks of how God's people, in their anguish, turn their faces upwards towards their king and their God and curse them contemptuously. And here's the irony. This whole doomed situation, this kind of indwelling and incoming of the darkness, has only been brought about because Israel have stubbornly refused to turn their face towards God before now. See, if you don't know Israel's backstory, here's it in like 3 seconds. God called them to be his own people. He called them to live under his light, to live with him amongst them, presencing himself in the temple. They were called to be like God, to relate to him, and they rejected him. They ignored him. They refused to worship and acknowledge him. They turned their face away from God towards any and every object in the world around them. And a deep darkness came upon them. And if you've been here for the last 5 chapters, you would have seen that they are a people of bloodshed and violence, of bribery, of exploitation, of greed, a people that even goes so far as to sacrifice their own children in the fire for the sake of prosperity and fertility. So here's the irony. They embrace the darkness, ignoring God, and now they turn to God to curse him because they're now dwelling in that darkness. Well, let me put it this way. The darkness that has overtaken them has come from within them. The darkness that has overtaken them has come from within. Which actually brings us back to our question. Why is good's triumph incomplete, messy, and short-lived? And the answer is this, is that we, like Israel, have a darkness within us. A darkness that we often see in the world around us when we switch on the news, when we read our feed. Often it feels a bit like we're living in ancient Israel, how with the bleak state of the world. And yet, where does that come from? At some point, we've got to stop passing the buck and look within. And it's a darkness that really compromises all that we do. It makes a mess of our best intentions. A darkness that ensures that even if we achieve that goal of loving a person or helping out a person, it's so short-lived. You see, good's victory in reality is compromised because we are compromised. And you see this in your own life, if you're honest, I think. Try doing something genuinely good for someone else. And even if you pull it off, within 5 minutes, it's an exercise in self-glorification. Would it be kind of appropriate for me to kind of post this and hashtag how awesome I am? Or no, I'll do it more subtly. I'll just mention it to a friend and hope it comes up time and time again. Or I go out of my love and my generosity and help a friend with issues. But man, after about 15 minutes, man, they do have issues. And I don't want to deal with these. Aren't my issues. And so you love them in abstract, but in reality, it's so short-lived. Or how often do you promise that, no, I'm going to change. I'm not going to be that person anymore. But you're always that person anymore, returning to your tired, destructive, and dark tendencies. You see, is it any wonder our companies, our governments, our courts are compromised? You see, it's easy to project them out there like they're the giants that we need to slay. But they comprise us. We made them. They are us. And often those that slay giants become them. The darkness around comes from the darkness within. You see, and deep down there is that itch for good to triumph over evil. But it begs the question, doesn't it? Whose side are you on? Because when we watch a film like that or insert umpteen other films, we always insert ourselves into the role of the good person, the good guys. We're never the bad guys. Even people in prison who've done terrible things, they're never the bad guys. But sometimes we are, aren't we? The Russian novelist Solzhenitsyn Iskin put it like this. I'll read it out if you can't see it. And this was a man that suffered horrendous treatment in the gulags in Soviet Russia. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were only necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? You see, we are like Israel, deeply compromised, living. Yes, there is light, but there is a deep darkness that we have brought about. And that means that when we come, and this is kind of the point, when we come to Isaiah chapter 9, when Isaiah looks at this hope which we're about to see, we've got to see ourselves in the shoes of Israel. We've got to see that we, like Israel, need a hope beyond hope, a hope beyond ourselves. We need someone not compromised, someone who is unadulterated goodness and light, who is without division, undivided, who can defeat the evil out there and the evil that we have in here, whose victory is not temporary but eternal. You see, that's Israel's hope, but be under no mistake, that's our hope too. Which brings us to chapter 9. And it begins with a promise of relief from the doom. Chapter 9, verse 1. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. So there's this picture of restoration. And then in verse 2, here is this kind of image of light. The people who have walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. It's a bright, white, glowing, pulsating, shining hope. And notice, and we'll notice this as we go through, that this hope comes from the outside. It doesn't come from within. There's a light that breaks in. And this light, it turns chapter 8 and that picture of doom and destruction and gloom and darkness, it turns it on its head. Instead of despair, there's joy. In fact, if you have a look at verse 3, it's interesting. Isaiah uses four times he speaks of joy. The joy of the nation, the joy of the harvest, the joy of victory. This is kind of a comprehensive snapshot of what true joy looks like. This is the joy of getting the car park right outside the front of Maya at Garden City the day before Christmas. Christmas Eve. This is the joy of nailing that three-pointer. The joy when your tax return is three times bigger than you thought. But of course, it's more substantial. This is the joy of a beautiful marriage, of close friendship, of seeing a newborn child. This is the joy of beating a terminal diagnosis. You see, Isaiah piles these words for joy on top of each other because he wants us to know this is maximal, maximal joy. And then in verse 4, instead of enslavement, there is total freedom. He says this, for the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulders, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. And we don't have time to kind of trace it through, but this is Isaiah kind of grabbing all these pictures of the Old Testament of God's people coming out of slavery and saying, yes, put them all together. That liberation, that moment of release, that is what this is. And then in 5, there's this holistic picture of peace. Not war-torn and conflicted like Israel was, but where war and its weapons and its clothing even is burnt up. You see, this light of chapter 9 is the triumph of joy over despair, freedom over slavery, and peace over hostility. And notice it's not temporary. It's not compromised. It's not conflicted, it's comprehensive. It's absolute. And yet knowing what we know about people, knowing that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, it leaves you and me with the question of who is this? Who brings this triumph of good? Well, Isaiah doesn't leave us guessing, does he? Verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called a Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Isaiah points forward to a son that will be perfectly good, perfectly just, a perfect ruler. Not like any other man who's compromised, but a man who is perfect like God himself, and then who will win a perfect victory over darkness, bringing joy and justice and hope. And it's interesting that some 700 years after this, the biographers of Jesus, and there's 4, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, their messages are united on this. And this is the message that if you somehow, I don't know how you word, but invent a time machine, you go back 2,000 years to Galilee, you could see this perfect son. See him asleep as a babe in a feeding trough. You could have heard him burp and cry in Bethlehem. And then if you walked along with him, you would see him spreading his peace as he healed the lame, liberating those enslaved to darkness. And one of those 4 biographers, Matthew, makes this explicit, this connection. In fact, 3 of them do, but I'm going to read you from Matthew's that was read a little earlier. This is Matthew talking about Jesus. And leaving Nazareth, he, that's Jesus, went and lived in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people dwelling in darkness. And he goes on quoting verbatim. Matthew reflects on Jesus' life and his teaching, and he comes to the conclusion that his friend and his teacher is the bearer of this light, joy, freedom and peace. And that's really interesting, because if you don't know the story, Matthew, along with a bunch of other people, walked with Jesus around Israel for 3 years. They lived with him day in and day out. And what's weird about it is this. You know, someone will come up to you and say, oh, you know what, your mum is just the best. Or they'll come and say, your brother is just the best. Or your aunt or your uncle. And you think, you say yes, of course. But you think, oh man, if only you lived with them. Right, sure, they look good church Sunday morning. They look great at Bible study. They look good, I don't know, having coffee. In short spurts, they're great, don't get me wrong. But man, if you lived with them. And I have a feeling that the only exception to this in history is Jesus. He is the only one with whom you would live for 3 years and come away saying, as Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and the disciples said, he's different. He does not have a divided, compromised heart. He loves without wanting in return. He gives without demanding anything back. He smiles, but he actually cares. He listens. And he doesn't care what I think of him. He's willing to say the hard truths, even though he knows I'll hate him for a time. He is the only truly good man. And the stories of the gospel, this story of the Bible, is that that itch that we have that we want scratched of evil defeating darkness? We might daydream about it being us, but we know it's not us. We know we're too compromised. It is Jesus Christ alone who is good and powerful enough to do it. And Jesus is no fiction. But the one thing he has in common with fiction is that in his story, evil is completely banished forever. That is what, if you want to know, that is what the cross and resurrection are all about. Jesus defeats the darkness out there, but also the darkness in the here. And it's a truth, yes, it's a truth that we only experience in part now. But the promise of the resurrection is that it will be an experience that we have in full when Jesus returns, bringing his joy, his liberation, his peace. That is the hope of the Christian. That is what defines us. And to close, let me point out one thing. Do you notice how passive we are in chapter 9? We don't do anything, actually. It's all about what God does through his son, through the king, through himself. All we do is receive. We receive the joy, we receive the peace, we receive the promises. It's all grace. That's it. That's gift language. It's all a gift that God gives to us. And that's what defines us as Christians. We're no better. We see our deep compromise. We're probably more honest about it than most. But we know that in Jesus, there is a promise that that darkness is taken away. That on the cross, our sin, because that's the word, I haven't used it, but that's the word, our sin on him was slain, and there by darkness slain, as the hymn sings, he died in our place, offering us joy, peace, and a triumph over darkness. Well, I'm going to pray now. Father, we thank you so much that you loved us, that you sent your son Jesus for us, that he is the Prince of Peace. He is the one that is just and true and kind and good and uncompromised. And Father, I just pray that you might, if we know that truth, may we hold it more nearly. And if we don't yet, I just pray that you might work in us, that we might come to know and love you. In Jesus' name, amen.